As we're coming up to Christmas time, I think I should probably give a Dhamma talk about Christmas. And I mentioned a little bit before, but for the benefit of those who weren't here, but I'm not sure if you saw the Anglican Church poster for Christmas in New Zealand. Most of you were here before, so we've seen it, but it basically has Mary and Joseph lying in bed together. Roy's seen it. It's one of the most successful poster, and the caption is, "Poor Joseph, God, such a hard act to follow." I'm kind of wondering whether it's possible to do a Buddhist version of that. But anyway, brilliant piece of work. I mean, the whole point of it is to question the. It's always like to almost make vivid or make it bring home to people how ridiculous it is when we start interpreting these kind of religious ideologies and myths as being literal, yeah? And so, of course, we always, you know, say, you know, Mary was a virgin and is the son of God and all of these kinds of things. And if you start to sort of follow through this in a rational or literal way, it becomes, you know, immediately ridiculous. I mean, you've got accounts in the Gospels of how Jesus' lineage sort of traced down through his father and things like this, you know? And you know, look at a sort of genetic basis, how do you mix the DNA up and so on if you don't have a father and so on and so forth. So it all becomes very silly, and the theologians in the Catholic Church sort of then tie themselves into knots because, you know, Mary's supposed to be ever virgin, but Jesus and all his brothers and sisters, apart from anything else, which is another sort of problem which they kind of argue about, were they real brothers, were they just half-brothers, and so on and so forth. And so all of this comes from a really kind of a misunderstanding of what the nature of religious or spiritual truth and these stories is all about. You know, in the story or the myth of Jesus' birth, you know, we're very familiar with a lot of these kind of mythic aspects to it. You know, the mother was a virgin and so on. And somebody who's a student of myth and a student of religious history, it's immediately very apparent how these kinds of things are very common motifs and often, in fact, universal. So, for example, the idea that Mary was a virgin. Now, this is something which, of course, hex-critical scholars will analyse this particular idea and show that there's no... If you look at all of the earliest sources of the life of Jesus, as generally accepted, the earliest sources are the letters of Paul, which were written before any of the Gospels were written. That's the earliest source. Second source is the, I believe, Q, which is the postulated antecedent of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And then the third source would probably be Mark itself, I think. A bit fuzzy on the details, but anyway, all of the early sources none of them include the virgin birth idea. Matthew is the first source that introduces it. Luke repeats it and elaborates it on even greater detail. But by the time you get to John, which is the latest gospel, then the virgin birth is omitted again, not because it's too miraculous, but because it's not miraculous enough. And John is a very kind of transcendental and metaphysical narrative, and Jesus has become nothing less than the Logos which pre-existed from the beginning of time. So a kind of virgin birth story is not big enough, not adequate enough for John's account of Jesus. So even within that very kind of simple text-critical approach, you sort of divide up the text into earlier and later strata, and you can see that these things evolved over a period of time. Popular and philosophical and theological conceptions of these things develop, and the role and importance changes during the history. I'm not sure if, often in Buddhism, especially in modern Buddhism, we tend not to emphasize these things, but of course the Buddha, according to the traditional accounts, also had a virgin birth. We don't tend to make such a big deal about it. But it's definitely there as a motif in the early scriptures. And there's quite a lot of the ancient accounts, not I'll come to the canonical account in a minute, but the mythological accounts of the Buddha's life, which emphasized that the Buddha's father, Suddhodana, wasn't actually sleeping with his mother, Maya, on the night that he was conceived. And so many of you may, you know of the dream that Maya dreams of a six-tusked white elephant, which is the kind of the dream, the auspicious dream that she has, symbolizing her conception. And so that night, again, according to the mythological accounts, Suddhodana wasn't with her. So even though Maya's not supposed to be a virgin in that kind of sense, but it was certainly supposed to be a miraculous conception. And the same is true of most of, or just about all of, the great heroes and religious figures of the ancient world. And one of the things that you learn, or gradually learn to notice, is that these things, so for example, this particular time we're talking about is sometimes called the birth of the hero. And the birth of the hero is something which is told through these ideas. And these ideas have layers of meaning which can be unpacked and can be discerned, and which will and the way that the ideas are played with in each particular case will determine or will shape the expression of what kind of hero that we're dealing with. Of course, there's always a tendency over time to move from a more naturalistic or humanistic description towards a more miraculous and symbolic description of these things. Now, in the case of the idea of the virgin birth, you know, what's actually going on there? What is the symbolism of that? What does it mean? Why traditions often insist on these things. I think it's one of the things that's very interesting about mythology is how strongly religious traditions insist on these things, while at the same time rarely reflecting on what they mean. So there's a very strong conscious insistence that these texts must be true, that this impossible miracle must really have happened and it's literally true and so on. And yet there's very little ability to reflect about it and to reflect on what it means. And people are often very satisfied with what to me seem to be quite shallow or inadequate explanations of these things. So one of the possible meanings or possible interpretations of the virgin birth motif is the idea of purity. And so this is kind of associated a reflection of the idea which is often found that sexuality and the body and so on is something which is dirty and polluting. And so there's this kind of strand of thought which is found in different spiritual traditions. There's definitely something to that in the description of the Buddha's own birth, as found in the early Pali Canon. It's described in terms which are very almost kind of in denial of the reality of birth itself. You know, it says that, you know, the Buddha was like in the womb, he was like a gem, like a diamond on a pure silk cloth. And then when he was born, that there wasn't any mess or dirt or blood or anything like that. That he was entirely clean and didn't even need to be washed after he was born. But nevertheless, that these magic jets of warm and cool water appeared in the sky and to there to wash the baby and the mother, even though they didn't really need washing because they were perfectly clean and there wasn't any pain or mess or anything like that. So obviously it was an account of, first thing you can say, it was an account of birth that was written by a man, right? I think we can agree that's pretty obvious. And we can also see that it's almost like going out of its way to emphasize and to divorce itself as far as possible from the reality of birth. Yeah? So it's not an attempt to describe a natural birth. It's an attempt to get as far away from that to almost like mirror it or to wrench it away from a naturalistic description. Something extraordinary is happening. Okay, so this is what the text is telling. Something extraordinary is happening. So underlying that, then of course there's clearly these concerns and like a sense of revulsion or impurity about the body and about especially about women's body, which is underlying that. That I think is one level or one sort of layer of the onion skin, if you like, that you're kind of peeling off to sort of see the truth of these things. But it doesn't, to me, that doesn't exhaust the meaning of the story. One of the things that I really love about these myths and symbols and so on is that you can continue to unpack them, and you can continue to come back to them and look at them in all kinds of different ways. And that looking at them from different angles, they're very multivalent, so that the same symbol can be seen as being quite negative in one way or quite positive in another way. And so the things which we look at originally, which we might react to or respond to in one way, then on further contemplation can be seen in quite a different light. So this is the same with the symbol of the virgin birth. Like on the one hand you can say, well, on a historical point of view, you can say, well, look, you can maybe dismiss it, you can be dismissive or cynical about it. It's a later interpolation, it's not authentic and so on. Okay? So then, let's get over that, right? We know that. Let's kind of move on. Well, then what does it mean? Why was it important for the Buddhist tradition to put that in there? And so then probably the most obvious response is the one I've just described, that it expresses in some way an alienation from the body, and in some ways an alienation and revulsion, especially from women's bodies. And so I think that's part of it. And that's kind of a psychological aspect of how the text is being presented. But again, in terms of modern or sort of postmodern critiques of this kind of passage, often that's where it tends to end up, but I don't think that exhausts the meaning by any means. Look at how birth narratives and the birth of the hero are depicted. There's always something about the birth of the hero which is extraordinary or special, and that can be played out in many ways. The details of how it's spelled out and dealt with are always different. But one thing which is common to all of these things, common to all the mythologies of the virgin birth or the hero's birth, is that in some ways it's about the appearance of something new. It's the appearance of something unprecedented, and in a sense that signals a shift. So in ordinary birth, when a child is born, the child in a way is conceived of or is a continuation of the parents. Yeah? So we see ourselves in relationship with our parents and continuing that line. And probably people in ancient times, that was a much stronger feeling than it is for us today. There's a feeling that you're continuing that family line. There's a tradition, there's a lineage. But there's also, I think, a consciousness and awareness among people that there are times in history when that shifted. There are times in history we have to account for newness in the world. So as well, so through a lineage, through, for example, like a family lineage or a royal lineage or something like that, or a Sangha lineage, we can account for continuity in the world. But we also have to account for change. We also have to account for the fact that things appear in the world for the first time. And if we look at a lot of all of the great culture heroes, they're always associated in some way or another with the first appearance of things. So, for example, Osiris in Egypt is another, appeared from another virgin birth narrative, that he was responsible for introducing the grain, the cultivation of wheat, and introduced beer. Dionysus was introduced the wine, Athena introduced the olive, and so on and so forth. So everyone's sort of responsible for bringing some kind of innovation, something that became foundational or important for the development of culture. So this is another aspect of the virgin birth, is that it's a way of expressing a sense of a break with continuity and the introduction of something new which has appeared. And that something new is very often conceived of as descending from the heavens, or being in some way related to the heavens. So, of course, in the Jesus' birth narrative, then, of course, you have the star over Bethlehem. appearing. And then, of course, there's the rationalizing approach to that, or maybe there was a special constellation there or conjunction, or maybe there was a comet had appeared in the sky or something like that, or a meteor, and then this is how you explain it. Yeah. And you know, it just happens to be the case that a comet or a constellation or a meteor or some other kind of sign appeared in the sky when every other hero and god and so on was born into the world. So from a mythological point of view, we don't bother with those kinds of rational explanations, which is not to say that they're necessarily untrue. If that may be the case, and it often is the case that you know, natural coincidences like that can be used for, and they can become a part of the mythology. And there was an interesting example of that when I was at Wat Manachan, and we had heard word at Wat Manachan about Ajahn Jagaro, and many years have passed now, so you might not be familiar, but Ajahn Jagaro was the original abbot of Bodhinyana Monastery, where Ajahn Brahm is. And he was a very well-known teacher and so on, and he disrobed about 15 years ago. And that was quite a shock at the time. And I was just a young monk then, and it was a bit of a kind of reverberations in the community. And we came back one morning, and there was this big, huge tree that was at the front of the sala, the hall at Wat Manachan, that had kind of fallen over. And of course, the temptation was to link them, and they hadn't actually fallen on the same day that he disrobed, but it became the same day fairly quickly. Yeah. So history was kind of, you could see that mythologizing process happening. Yeah, in that very space. Yeah. Oh, yeah, the tree fell on the same day, and then somebody would interrupt and say, "Well, it wasn't quite the same day," but you know, trying to resist that process is. And you can see how time shifts these things, right? So if you're actually living there at that time, it's perfectly obvious. We get the news on Wednesday that Ajahn Jagaro disrobed, and then on Saturday the tree falls over. Yeah, there's the difference between those times is obvious. A week later, then it becomes, oh yeah, well, you know, it was at the same time. No, it wasn't. A month later, a year later, 10 years later, 100 years later, that's receded so far in the distance that the difference in time doesn't matter anymore. Yeah? This is, again, is how the mythologizing process works. You can actually see it in action. So with this thing like the lights appearing in the sky and so on, being associated with the birth of the hero, and that can be figured in a very direct and very literal way, that the hero was born in the Buddha's myth, that the Buddha was born into Tusita heaven, and passed away from Tusita heaven and was reborn in this life. So again, part of that the mythic or the symbolic meaning of that is the appearance of something new, and the idea of the heavens, in a sense, always has a see, this is one of the things we miss out in modernity. We can't see the heavens anymore. Yeah, we're actually not too badly off in Australia. We've got such clear skies that you can still see the stars. Yeah, but we're often so shrouded by the light in the city that you can't see the stars very much anymore. And if you go to most cities in the world, certainly in Asia, you can't see any stars at all. You just see this yellow soup. When you look up at night time, it's terrible. But the stars are this almost crystalline, perfect world, which somehow exists mysteriously independently of the messy world that we live in down here. And whereas our world here is characterized by change, by decay, by competition, by mess and by dirt and disease and death and so on, the stars are just there. They just shine in their light eternally, and their movements are perfect. And so it's very natural to want to identify the stars. It creates this idea of this perfect heavenly world where the ambiguities and the suffering that we experience so much in our reality here are not present there. And this is the appeal of the stars, the sort of the romantic attraction of the stars. When that motif of the light appearing in the sky is associated with the birth of the hero, it's almost like the feeling that this world of eternity and perfection, where the patterns and the cycles, it's almost like this crystalline mathematical world has entered into, like an avatar, has entered into our world. So we've like received this kind of injection from the abstract or the world of the perfect, the world of the divine, into our human world. And so that, in a sense, it sanctifies our human world, it sanctifies our life, that we are worthy of the attention of those divine powers, and that our world has become that much more special because the divine has entered into it in this way. So this is another aspect of the idea of the virgin birth, but I think there's an even more subtle and more profound aspect of the virgin birth. It's not just a garbled attempt at history. It's not just a psychology. It's not just a sense of the divine or the sacred. But there's something which I think is even more, for me, more subtle and more fundamental, which is the notion of existence itself. And this, of course, is one of the great philosophical or existential question is, what is this? What is this life? What is this place? Who am I? Where do I come from? And these are some of the most fundamental questions that we can ask ourselves, and those questions and that sense of wonder which has informed and inspired humanity's spiritual search. So if you look in any spiritual tradition, we always find origin myths, this question of where do things come from? What is the origin? What's the core? And it's interesting that for example, in theistic religions, that one of the most philosophical expressions of how theists perceive their God is as a cause. Right? So God is the prime mover. God is the uncaused cause. This is how the theologians will express their understandings of God. So something about us, that something about us wants to seek our origins, wants to seek our source. And so, yeah, in a sense, this has a psychological aspect as well. But it is, I think, in a sense, deeper than mere psychology, in the sense that it's an existential search. Why is there something rather than nothing? Where does this world come from? Can we ever answer that? And so in trying to tell these myths of origins, origin of the universe, the creation mythologies, humans have everywhere and all times grappled with this, and they try to tell a story which is going to account for that in a meaningful way. And of course we're still doing that, and we still create origin myths constantly, through science, whether through religion, whether through fiction and creative imagination. We're telling ourselves origin stories all the time. So the virgin birth, in a sense, is a kind of origin story. And just as at an ultimate level, or the deepest level, you have to account for the fact that something, why is there something rather than nothing? So something has come to be that wasn't through the ordinary process of cause and effect and for generation. We can't explain the very existence of the universe through an ordinary process of cause and effect. You have to postulate something else, which is outside that. And so this is, to me, another layer of meaning of the virgin birth motif, is that it specifically breaks that cycle of cause and effect. Yeah? Of course, we all know that a child is conceived because of the union of the mother and the father. But this has now broken that. Something else has appeared, something which is new. So one of the implications of that is that this is a moment of potential and a moment of possibility. We can't, because it's not something that occurs according to the ordinary process of cause and effect, it's not predictable. we can't determine, well, because the mother was like this and the father was like this, therefore the child is going to be like that. We can't infer from those things. So the child becomes something which is in a way hovering between possibilities. And this idea of hovering between possibilities is actually quite literally figured in the mythologies as well. And there's one of the Jataka stories, the Katahari Jataka, which quite literally depicts this. That there's I won't go into the whole story, but there's a dispute about the paternity of the baby. And of course, the baby is the bodhisattva. The father is the king. The mother was a stick-gathering girl. And the king had his way with her. She became pregnant. She gave birth. She came back. The king gave her a ring, okay, and said, if it's a son, if you have a son, bring him to me. So she brings the son to the king, and he denies that he's the father. Right? He's embarrassed because everyone's going to know what he did with this stick collecting girl, right? So he says, "No, it wasn't me. It's not my son." Okay. So it wasn't just now that all these kind of celebrities and everyone's trying to sort of hold their children off and get them child support and so on, but happening in the past as well. King says, no, it's not my son. So and he says, no, it's not my ring. So the mother says, okay, well, if you don't believe that, let's do a test of truth. So she takes the baby, the bodhisattva, wasn't really a baby, it was a child at that time, and by the ankle, and throws him into the air. So the mum tosses the baby up into the air to see who's going to catch him. Right? And so, of course, the baby, being the bodhisattva, sat cross-legged in meditation in mid-air, right? And is hovering, right, between the mother and the father. Yeah, very beautiful, again, very beautiful symbolic depiction. Yeah, he's hovering between the mother and the father, sitting cross-legged. And he says some verses, sings some verses. He says that the father is the king, and as the king should look after the whole of the kingdom, should like look after all the beings within his kingdom. Even more so, he should look after his own son. So, of course, that, in a sense, that again, that particular motif can be read on a psychological and developmental way as well. Yeah, there's a time which is usually the time of initiation for children in tribal societies, where they sort of move out of the sphere of influence of the mother and move into the sphere of influence of the father, and that's a very common developmental model. So, you know, in a sense, that's what that depicts. But also, there's that emphasis, like the peak, the emotional peak of the story is that time when the bodhisattva is hovering in midair. And that's when the story actually breaks into verses, breaks into song. Yeah, and so it's not appealing to that kind of linear thinking anymore. We've broken out of that linear thinking. The world of reality is broken down and you're into a world of potential. So at that time then the king of course, leaps forward and says, "Come here, my son," and the child comes down into the king's arms. Yeah? And then they marry, the king marries the girl, and they live happily ever after and so on. But that's not an isolated incident or an isolated motif. In the Buddha's last birth is called Vesantara. And the word Vesantara literally means in between all. Okay? In between all. And it's said that he was born neither in his mother's home nor in his father's home. He was born on the road in between. So this is why he's called in between all. Yeah? And of course the Buddha in his last life, Siddhartha in this life, was born in the same situation. Yeah, on the road back from his father's house to his mother's house, in between all. Yeah, in between the mother and the father, he's born in the forest. Yeah? So this is, he's gone back to the realm of nature. Again, realm of nature representing, in a sense, potential and possibility. It's not constrained by the confines of culture and the constructs that you find in the city or the expectations. When we go back into the wild, you never know what's going to happen. You don't know what's behind that bush. You don't. It's not an area where you control. The city's controlled. It's all straight lines and squares. Nature is out of your control. You don't know what's there. So he's in that area, that place of potential. This is, for me, this is another very important part of that motif. And again, being Similarly, with Jesus' birth, is that he's born on a journey and born with the animals and so on, and not being in a place where he's constrained by the confines of culture. So these are some of the aspects or some of the ideas which are contained in that motif of the hero's birth, which we find again and again in these stories. Another aspect of it in the Christmas narrative, of course, is the three wise men. And again, from a critical point of view, you can analyze historically what was likely to happen, and there's of course many different versions of it, and are they wise men or are they kings and so on, and you could say that they some people would say that they're Buddhist monks, wise men from the East who sort of come along, could be, or Persian sages or something like that. But again, we have a similar thing in the life of the Buddha, in the birth, the early account of the birth of the Buddha, that the devas appear to greet him and to rejoice in his birth. And the slightly later phase of development of the story, you have the story of the sage Asita, and this one's told in the Sutta Nipata, where the sage Asita is meditating, and he sees all the gods rejoicing in the heavens. And he thinks, why are the gods all rejoicing in the heavens? And so he goes up and asks them, and they say they're rejoicing because of the birth of Siddhartha. And so he goes down shortly after the birth and sees the child, and then bursts into tears. A very famous motif in the life of the Buddha. He bursts into tears, and the king says, "What's the matter? Is there something inauspicious? Is there some bad sign about the birth?" He says, "No. I'm only crying because your child will become a Buddha, and I will die before I had the chance to see him and to hear his teachings." So this is this prediction of his future enlightenment. And of course a similar thing with Jesus and the three wise men coming. So it's almost like again, in a sense, that has a very, it has a social meaning, in the sense that it has a kind of propaganda or PR value. You know, you're saying, well, the wisest guys that were around before this were still, even before this new hero, the previous heroes, all they were good for was really worshipping at the feet of our new hero. Even when he was a little baby, he was already better than they were. Yeah? So it's a very straightforward kind of PR spin that's involved there. Again, there are more subtle kind of dimensions to that. I mean, one aspect of that which is interesting is it implies in some way that there's an evolution, or that there's a movement in consciousness and in awareness, that the wisdom which we have and which is encapsulated even within the wisest people who are alive, that wisdom is not complete or final, in a sense. There is a growth, there is a movement of that wisdom, and an acknowledgement that humanity has new insights and new ways of seeing things. So in a sense, this also plays with that notion of tradition and change, or continuity and change, because especially in traditional societies, anything new was much more difficult to get across and to persuade people to accept anything new. There's much more emphasis on the continuity of tradition. And so to remember that within the actual cultural conditions of a society, that there were very good reasons for that, that it was very difficult, for example, to pass down knowledge from one generation to another. Yeah? It was very difficult to maintain the stability of a society. There was a lot more uncertainty, violence and war and all of these kinds of things going on. And so there was a much stronger need to maintain a continuity, a sense of cultural, tribal, linguistic continuity from one generation to the next. And so anything new that came along was very challenging. Now today we live in a society which is almost defined by our obsession with the new, by our love of change. we get completely bored with the same thing very, very quickly. And yet even so, or perhaps because we're so obsessed with the new and with changing things, there are still many things within our own society which are still very, very resistant to change and which want to preserve the things of the past. And of course we've seen that in our own tradition with the Bhikkhuni ordination recently, that there's this issue of continuity of tradition versus change and innovation has become very paramount. So change will always come with trauma, and there will always be a degree of conflict, there will always be forces that resist change, which is exactly how it should be. Yeah? There's no history evolves as the dynamic and the interplay between these things. There's certainly no sense in which you can say that innovation is always right. Innovation is always a two-edged sword. A new situation comes along and that will have advantages and disadvantages just as the old situation did. These things will always be in a state of dynamic tension. One of the ways that change can be facilitated or eased is through this kind of approval of the elders. And this is what we've been seeing in these origin myths, that even though there's something radically new has appeared in the world, a kind of breaking through the veil of the world and an appearance of something unprecedented, but still there's an affirmation that the highest level or the highest representatives of the preceding generation and the preceding tradition will give their approval to these new innovations and these new changes. And so this is, again, is a way, I see it as a way of marrying and reconciling these conflicting aspects of change and continuity. One of the things that we try to, we always have to try to resist, or this tendency in looking at mythology and so on, is to try to make them consistent and try to come up with a reasonable, rational, or final explanation of these things. And this was a point that was became a focal point for the thinking of Levi-Strauss, who was an anthropologist who dealt a lot with mythology and so on. He passed away quite recently. And he looked at this notion of alternatives, and like logical alternatives. So many of his books have these kind of names, like the sacred and the profane. Right? So you set up these two categories, the sacred and the profane, or another one is the raw and the cooked. Yeah, so we divide the world up. We have the raw and the cooked. So he looked at the way these different categories are kind of worked in society and through the mythologies. And one of the things that you notice, of course, is that once you try to make a category like that, so say the sacred and the profane, where you can say, well, fine, a Buddha Rupa is sacred and a trash can is profane. And so you know, you've got a clear idea that there's these separate domains of life, and we can separate them out. We put the Buddha Rupa in a high place. We treat it with respect, and we worship it with incense and so on. We don't put the trash can up next to it and worship the trash can with it. We hide that away in the kitchen and pretend not to notice it, right? And so we have this. We want to separate these things out, but of course that separation is never complete and it's never perfect. There's always grey areas, there's always ambiguity. And one of the things that Levi-Strauss noticed is that those grey areas and ambiguities are addressed in the way that people handle and relate to their mythologies, and that the stories will be told and retold in slightly different ways that always express some kind of unease about these areas where things break down, and that indicates, in some ways, that becomes a way that a community or that the people can deal with and can cope with this very fact of ambiguity. So, for example, in this life of the Buddha, the question that I raised before: well, is it a natural historical birth? Are we dealing with the actual birth of a human being in a time and a place? Or are we dealing with a divine, miraculous event? Okay, and the tradition, in a sense, wants to have it both ways. Yeah, so we want to, at the one hand, insist, yes, that the Buddha was a real historical human being. We want to be able to go. We want the archaeologists to be able to dig up the remains at Kapilavastu and say, this is where the Buddha was brought up. We want to be able to go to Lumbini and say, this is the place where the birth happened. Yeah? So we want to actually have a place and a date and a people, real people. But at the same time, we want it to be something miraculous. We want it to be something that's divine, something that's impossible. And so the way that the story gets told in different ways, from different perspectives at different times, we'll negotiate that in different ways. So sometimes it'll be told from a more naturalistic perspective, sometimes from a more miraculous perspective, and these things are constantly shifting within the community. So from this way of looking at the mythology, it's not a matter of sort of dividing up these sort of the historical versus the mythic approach to it, but more looking at the way that these different aspects are played with within the community as it sort of grapples with these issues in history. So when the Buddha was born, one of the other things that usually happens in the myth of the hero is that the hero has to prove themselves at a very early age. So for example, in the myth of Hercules, when he was born, these two huge snakes, sort of while he was still lying in his cot, you know, just being born, and these two huge snakes were kind of sent in to assassinate him and I think his brother as well, And of course, you know, massive great pythons coming to swallow this little baby, and Hercules, of course, just grabs one in either hand and just wrings their necks, you know. And it was the first of many adventures that he had. So, and the Buddha, when he was born, Siddhartha, his first acts is described in very startling ways, very extreme, really. If you look in the Pali, the language that's used is quite extreme. And it says he after he's born, he stood firmly on his two feet. And then he took seven mighty strides to the north. Okay, so it doesn't say seven steps. There's this particular idiom that uses in the Pali, sata paravihihara, and it's vi-api-hara, and it uses a double prefix, both of these being emphatic prefixes, and a doubly emphatic prefix. If you translate it as a mighty stride, something like that. So these seven mighty strides to the north. And there he surveyed the four quarters and roared out with the voice of a bull, "I am the greatest in the world." Yeah? There's this whole Muhammad Ali thing going on. Yeah? I am the best in the world. Seto hamasmi lokasa, jeto hamasmi lokasa. I am the eldest in the world. Right? He's just been born, right? And he's crying out, "I jeto hamasmi lokasa. I am the oldest one in the world." Yeah. This is my last birth. Now I'm finished. I'm not coming. I'm not doing this again. So you can imagine mum and...
what?
And, you know, again, it's kind of attempts to rationalize this, and people will say that there were episodes when babies were able to talk soon after they were born. Maybe that's so. Maybe it's a karmic thing or whatever. But if you look at the description as it is in the suttas, it doesn't strike me as being something that was sort of calculated to appear as a naturalistic or historical event. And when reading these, there are these signifiers which these passages will give you, which almost tell you, you learn to recognize these things, that they tell you this is a myth. And so one of them, for example, is a very common one. One of the most common of all of them is the use of the number seven. And it says he took seven strides to the north. And number seven is constantly used through all mythologies as meaning mythic number. The number seven being strongly connected with astronomy and astrology. It's connected with the cycles of the stars, the seven visible planets, five planets and the sun and the moon. And also the quarters of the lunar cycle. And so the number of seven always sort of having the signification of the entire cycle of birth and death, the entire cycle of the world. And so constantly appearing in all the mythologies of the world. And so when you see that number appearing, it's like the text is telling you, you know, beam, 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 beam. It's not meant to be a real number. It's a symbolic number. It's a symbolic narrative. So there's this baby roaring out with the voice of the bull, I'm the greatest in the world. It's not a particularly modest kind of claim. And, you know, I don't think, personally, I don't think that there should be a, you know, I don't think we should be trying to give it a naturalistic or realistic interpretation. It's quite clearly a myth. And again, we find there's similar things in all the different birth narratives. And also similar ideas in their own way. Similar ideas are still used to justify different spiritual, sort of a sense of spiritual charisma or spiritual aura around teachers. We think of, for example, the Tibetan talkus and so on, and you know, when they go and they search out for who's the, you know, next Dalai Lama or the next Karmapa or something, and they find the child, and the child's able to identify the objects from the past life. Yeah, so you know, again, in a sense here, we're doing the same thing. You know, we're finding these same miraculous things that a child can do that in some way express their own special destiny. These are just some few examples that I've mentioned, which are parallels between the life of Jesus and the life of the Buddha. It's sometimes been said that the birth narrative in the Gospels was in some way influenced by the Buddhist account of the account of the Buddha's birth. It may be so, although I think that there are so many mythic and parallels between all of these things that it's difficult to trace a particular or specific source for these kinds of ideas. But I think it is interesting just to look at both the similarities and the differences in terms of what the meaning of these things are. They always have something to teach us, you know, and this is something that I'd just like to encourage, is that in a sense, these things haven't come to us for no reason. And I think this is something which where I part ways with a lot of the kind of the modern secularists and atheists. You know, Dawkins and his crew, they can tend to be very dismissive of religion because it's not rational or whatever. But there's a sense in which, look, these are ideas which have shaped, resonated with, informed the minds and the consciousness of countless people for thousands of years. In fact, virtually everybody in the world. So on the one hand, you can dismiss it and say, well, virgins can't give birth, and say, well, it's irrational and it's wrong and it didn't happen. But you're cutting yourself off from an understanding of that aspect of humanity. Surely there must be something about it that has some kind of meaning. And so the way I try to approach these things is to accept that there is in some way a resonance and a meaning to them, and to try to reach out to that, to try to listen and to respond to those stories, and to try to find a meaning which in some way can inform my own understanding of myself and of Buddhism and the way that Buddhism appears and manifests in the world. So there's just some thoughts and reflections for you this evening on the mythology of the birth of the hero, the birth of the Buddha and Jesus. So I offer this to you for your reflection and contemplation. And anyone have any comments or questions?
Pipanna bhagavato sa